Accession number 4656, room number 2.
Sefton Reel 2. Could you describe what Egypt was like as a station in the late 20s?
Yes. It was not bad. We were stationed outside Cairo in a place called Helwan, which was supposed to be a spa with the sulfur baths, where Egyptians used to go and take the waters. We, as a squadron, we used to go on Wednesday afternoon. Instead of sport, we used to go down to the sulphur baths. They were very foul, actually, if you swallowed any, but they were supposed to be good for rheumatism. There was one man there, a telephone operator. I think he'd been there ever since the war, and he thought it was doing him a power of good, and he signed on time after time, and as far as I know, he never left Helwan. But as a station, it was a fairly happy squadron, 45 bomber squadron. It was known as the Gold Medal Squadron, or the Flying Camel. Our motto was, our badge was a camel with wings, because it was a result of, during the war, First World War, the squadron was equipped with camel aircraft, and also it served in Italy, where it was sent to bolster the then Italian army, and it was alleged, reputed to have been presented by the King of Italy with a gold medal for its services to the forces in Italy during the First World War. Therefore, it was known as the Flying Camel or Gold Medal Squadron. We equipped with Fairey 3Fs. We policed the canal. We did daily reconnaissance around the canal, usual night flying. We also did the checking along the north of the territory, which would be along the Mediterranean, Mersa Matruh, Abakir, Alexandra, Port Said, down to Port Suez, and all stations down on the forced landing grounds. We kept the continuous wireless watch with the main station there, which I think was Ismailia. And at one time we had a detachment go to Ramleh, which was Transjordan, when there was some skirmishing breaking out between the Arabs and the Jews. That would be in 1929 or 1930, I'm not sure which.
Did you ever go to Palestine yourself?
Yes, I went to Ramleh, and from there I was there a little while, and from there we had a few little trips around to places like Jerusalem and various other places, and of course I collected various mementos from the places I went to. I've got them all spread around now.
How long was this trip to Ramleh? How long did it last?
Oh, it only lasted a short time, a trip to Ramleh. I think the squadron was only detached, had a flight detached for about 3 months, just until the skirmishing cooled off.
Now, after you'd been with number 45 squadron for 2 years, you were posted to number 216 Squadron, also in Egypt, but at Heliopolis in November 1930. Could you describe 216 Squadron and what your duties were there?
Yes, 216 was a Vickers Victoria troop carrying squadron. They had the big aircraft that carried, presumably to carry troops, and they were engaged in at some time or other carrying troops through to, at a later stage I understand, across to Baghdad and to India. But I had no flying experience with 216. My duties at Heliopolis was on the wireless station there on the Imperial Airways wave. We used to communicate, listen out for the Imperial Airways aircraft coming across the Mediterranean and landing at Gaza en route to Baghdad, across the desert to Baghdad, and we used to communicate or wait, listen for messages, communicate with Gaza, and if necessary, if the aircraft, Imperial Airways, were going south towards Khartoum, then we would need to communicate with them. But mostly it was coming across the Med and landing at Gaza that we were engaged in. There was two corporals at the time, and that was our sole duty from dawn to dusk duties on the wireless station.
So why, in fact, you were attached to 216 Squadron, you didn't have very much to do with it?
Nothing at all except for administration. I actually was on their strength, but I had no contact with their aircraft or anything like that. It was purely working with the Imperial Airways. I suppose it was their, you would call it their pioneering, their South Africa and their Baghdad routes from Gaza, which was across the Gaza Strip.
Do you remember any special instances of anything happening during your time?
While I was there, I was on watch. We were set up watch one day. We was expecting the airship, the R-100 or 101. Anyhow, there was an airship due to come over, and it was due to land at Ismailia, which was on the Bitter Lakes, which was also the central wireless station for that particular area, and it also had the mast for the airship to hook onto. But we were on watch that day waiting for the airship to arrive. It never came, and I learned later that it had crashed in France on that particular time, but we were on watch waiting for it that day.
How many flights were there normally? Was there one flight a day or two flights a day?
Imperial Airways flights would be one a day at landing at Gaza, as far as I could recollect. There may have been more, but I think one a day was because the man at Gaza was the jack of all trades. Not only was he the wireless operator, he had to refuel and service the aircraft and do everything once the aircraft landed. But I wouldn't be sure whether it was more than one aircraft a day, although we were on watch all day, so there may have been more.
But you were just on watch for Imperial Airways, you weren't doing anything for the RAF?
Nothing to do with the RAF or whatsoever, no.
Now, after being at Heliopolis for only a few months, you were posted home in April 1931.
Right, yes.
You've been overseas for more than 5 years by this time.
Five and a half.
Is this the usual length of overseas posting?
Well, the usual posting for a place like India was 5 years. The usual place for Iraq was two, but I volunteered for a third. But if you did two or three in Iraq, you invariably had to make up the five elsewhere, either in Egypt or some other place nearby, Transjordan, Amman, or perhaps Malta, Gibraltar, something like that. But 5 years was the normal overseas posting.
Having been overseas that long, was it anything of an adjustment to go back to England?
Yes, in a way, I found quite a lot of things changed. Family had moved. Life was a bit different in England, in the Air Force. There was more rigid discipline in England than there was overseas. Overseas was, discipline was fair, but it wasn't so rigid as it was in England. There wasn't the strictness on, there wasn't the number of parades, there weren't the ceremonial parades overseas that there was in England either before or after I came back.
When you came back home, you were posted back to the School of Army Cooperation at Old Sarum.
Yeah.
What were your duties there?
Duties there were training operators and, to a certain extent, pilots to do what I was doing in the 1925 manoeuvres, and that was cooperation with the army on the range finding of the guns when they went on Salisbury Plain. When they went on Salisbury Plain, I used to take the operators out to the various battery positions and hand them over, and then they would do what I did in 1925. They would take the messages from the aircraft and then pass them over to the battery commanders. That was while we were still doing army cooperation by Morse with the artillery.
Were there RAF squadrons attached to the school at Old Sarum, or did various squadrons come in at various times?
No, there was a permanent squadron there, number 16 squadron, which I did join for a while. And during my stay there, I took charge of a radio tender. We communicated by the radio telephony to the pilots in the air, whereas before we had been relying on Morse code telling us where the shells fell. When we transferred to radio telephony, I had a tender with one operator and a driver, and we used to get other troop movements, tank movements, all other sorts of information back from the aircraft, which we were able to pass over. It was a step forward from just spotting for guns, which the Air Force used to do previously. It was an advancement.
So they were doing reconnaissance as well as guns?
They were doing reconnaissance and was given sending back by information by radio, by speech rather than Morse code.
What sort of aircraft were number 16 squadron using?
16 squadron had Audax, the Hawker Audax, and at one time they had Harts.
Were you doing any flying at this time, or were your duties solely on the ground?
I did some flying at 16 Squadron and the School of Army Cooperation. We mostly did RT, taking the place of the officers in the aircraft, in the rear cockpit, giving messages down, taking them down, and passing the RT down to the ground stations. But normally the officers who were on courses there, they were mostly army officers who came to be trained, and we were giving them their training, basic training in radio telephony.
What were relations like between the Army and the Air Force at this time?
I thought the Army were a little stiff. The Army officers, I thought they thought more of their rank than the Air Force officers did, that you were working with day after day. There was a more standoffish. They pulled their rank more than the Air Force officers did.
You were at Old Sarum for almost 4 years, part of the time with the School of Army Cooperation and part of the time actually with Number 16 Squadron.
16 Squadron, yes.
What sort of accommodation was there at Old Sarum? Were you directly attached to Army units when you weren't with the squadron?
The accommodation was the same. It was hut accommodation, and there again, it was First World War hutments that we were in. There was barrack blocks built later on, but I never occupied a barrack block. I was in the hut, same hut in 16th Squadron as I was in School of Army Cooperation. It was, as I say, First World War hutments.
How often were you out in the field in manoeuvres?
Pretty frequently, because it was courses were going on all the time. Only if weather conditions were really bad when we couldn't get the aircraft out of the hangars were work stopped. It was a continual Monday to Friday exercise. All the year round.
Now, after your posting to Old Sarum, you were posted to Andover.
Yes. I went to Andover on the wireless station. No connection with the aircraft at all. It was purely and simply, I think, corporal in charge of a watchkeeper comprised of an NCO, so many operators, and I was the corporal in charge of the watchkeeping duty for so many hours a day, purely on watchkeeping duties, wireless.
Andover was just an RAF station. You were just attached to station headquarters, is that right?
Exactly, yes. There was a squadron there. I'm not sure what squadron it was, not now.
But you had nothing to do with the squadron?
But I had nothing to do with the squadron at all. I was purely on the main wireless station, receiving station.
You were at Andover for rather less than a year, because in January 1936 you were posted north to Montrose in Scotland.
Yes.
To a flying training school.
That's right, number 8 Flying Training School, and I was then classified, as you might say, a signals instructor, because we were taking in pilot officers, temporary pilot officers, with a view to forthcoming event, And one of my jobs was to give them the basic principles of Morse code, a rough idea of what wireless was all about, what they would be expected to meet up with when they got to a squadron, because they had come from a civilian flying school, and they were then sent to Montrose to learn to become officers, both from a flying point of view and from a signals point of view. From my point of view, I used to give them cinematograph pictures of what was expected of them to do, and also we used to do night flying, orders lab training, Morse code training, and general elementary principles of wireless, just sufficient for them to know that it was something different from armoury or something like that, you see.
By this time, was the emphasis more on wireless telephony than on Morse code?
Yes, it was more on, we gave them Morse so that they could use a Morse lamp, an Aldis lamp, for landing, because we used to do night flying there. They used to do all the basics for flying, night flying, day flying, until they went solo and had passed out in flying. And I used to take them and give them brief exams on what I've been training them to do, but mostly it was learning more radio. Morse was confined mostly to Aldis lamp with lamp signalling for night flying purposes and bringing them in when there was their turn to come in.
What sort of aircraft were used at the flying training school?
I'm not sure. It was a dual aircraft because the instructors used to take them up and give them dual control until they passed out. But I'm not sure what sort of aircraft was involved, because I had really very little to do with aircraft. It was mostly ground signalling and ground training that I had to give them.
Was there any feeling at this time that the RAF might be preparing for an upcoming war?
Well, I think it was without a doubt in my mind that it was forthcoming, because these officers, pilot officers, were signed on for 4 years short service commission, and at the beginning of 1936, it was obvious that the pressure was on us to get as many through in their training so that they could pass on. To my mind, there wasn't any doubt at all.
There were more people coming in for training than had been the case in the past.
Well, Montrose had been opened up specially. That Montrose was a First World War airfield. It had been closed, and then when we went there, and number 8 FTS, it had been opened up specially to train pilots for a forthcoming event. It had lied dormant ever since, in between times.
After 2 years at Montrose in early 1938, you were hospitalised for a while at Halton.
Yes.
What was wrong with you?
Pardon?
What was wrong with you?
There was one thing I ought to mention at Montrose before I left there, and that was that I took a violent dislike to bagpipes, because CO Group Captain de Crepney was a bagpipe fan, I think. He had Reveille on the bagpipes, Lights Out on the bagpipes, He had all the bugle calls, etc., one normally gets on a station on the bagpipes, and every Sunday we marched through Montrose, followed by a bagpipe band. Since then, I've been rather, not been very keen on bagpipes. Having left Montrose, I think that was due to the fact that I spent lots of time at night flying, not literally night flying, but engaged in night flying duties on the end of the flare path. You should do regular night flying. It was very cold. The aerodrome was right on the cliffs. Between us and the sea was just a few sand dunes, and it was a very, very cold weather. You should do night flying in all weathers. And I used to spend nights after night, hour after hour, on the flare path with an Aldous lamp and perhaps somebody else, and the aircraft would be going around doing circles, and what they call circles and bumps, we call those circuits. We would be telling them to land by Aldous lamp and things like that. And I think that the cold weather, plus the unusual hours, long hours, stress and strain, and I finished up at Horton with, I can only say, I think it was a stomach ulcer.
This was an RAF hospital, was it?
Horton was a RAF hospital. It was the main RAF hospital.
And how long were you there for?
Long enough to have a major operation.
After you were released from hospital in April 1938, you were posted back to a squadron, the number 12 squadron, which at the time was stationed at Andover.
Yes. 12 squadron was, I didn't know at the time, but 12 squadron was a mobile squadron. And when I got there, we were re-equipping with ferry battles, which was the first time we'd worked on monoplanes. It was a monoplane engine with a Merlin engine. I went to ferries to get the basic principles of the extra electrical equipment, which was then being put on aircraft, whereas before there was very little electrical equipment on aircraft, but on the battle there was a lot more electrically operated bomb racks, etc., etc. And 12 squadron were re-equipping, and we were then training. It was pretty obvious then we were training full out with these particular aircraft. It was a different kind of an aircraft. It was a bomber aircraft, not very efficient as it turned out, but it carried a crew of three, a pilot with two guns through the front, twin Lewis at the back, and a bomb aimer underneath the pilot's feet for the purpose of sighting the bomb sites.
What were your own duties with number 12 squadron?
Well, I was a flight sergeant then. I was a flight sergeant, and I was in charge, sole charge, of the signal section. The signal section was comprised of 20 wireless operators, operator mechanics, electricians, and it was supervisory plus maintenance, and generally detailing the operators for what jobs they would do, what flights they would go on, and all that was attributed to the personnel in charge of the person in charge of the wireless section. I did have a officer who was classified as a signal officer, but he wasn't a trained signal officer. He was only a go-between between me and the CO, was actually, he was Pilot Officer Garland, who was eventually awarded the VC in the war. But he had no signals training, and he was had to ask me what we would do, what we suggest we do, what wireless we had available, what machines we had unserviceable for wireless, and then he would be the liaison with the commanding officer at the time.
So you wouldn't be doing that much flying yourself?
I only had one trip while I was at 12 Squadron. That was with Pilot Officer Garland, as he was then. I had one trip there as we went round on a local flight just to say that I'd flown in a battle and let me have a look and see what the conditions were and what the wireless was involved in a battle.
Number 12 Squadron, as you said, was a mobile squadron. Did that mean that it had any more equipment than a non-mobile squadron would have had?
It meant that we were under orders to shift, to go anywhere at any time. I think at the time when there was trouble in Ethiopia, or Abyssinia, Ethiopia, we were on readiness to go, and it transpired that we didn't need to. But that was our role. We were on constant readiness, a mobile squadron, to go at any time. We, on short notice, we were one of those that went.